week of May 20th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 410, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, not suffering from jet lag, I'm Michael Gilts. Welcome back, Sperling.
Thank you very much. I guess you are alluding to the fact that I just slept like 11 or 12 hours because I am very jet lagged getting back from the Cannes Film Festival.
And a parent with children, sleeping 12 hours is not easy to do.
No, it is not. I had to go to bed very, very early.
Like you took your chocolate milk, you had a little warm milk, you went to sleep, and you slept like a baby.
Yes, correct.
Very good. Well, you're back from Cannes. We'll certainly be covering that on this week's show. What else will we talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a wrap-up, as we just mentioned, of all the Cannes news, the big awards, the small discoveries, and whether anyone will bother heading to the south of France ever again just to see some obscure films. Spoiler alert, of course they will. China continues to make news thanks to a box office that sports diverse hits from all over the world, making the U.S. look positively parochial in comparison. Oh, and MoviePass is still kicking and screaming. Buried in a financial report were some solid numbers on how much money MoviePass is making from ads and the like. In television news, we discuss how we didn't really cover the TV upfronts, thus missing out on a key TV story. 2 weeks in a row, in fact. And we update you on Arrested Development. In sexual misconduct news, TV's NCIS franchise made news for good and bad reasons, while labels and artists push back a bit against Spotify, and these are record labels. The question is, was Spotify not woke enough when laying out new standards for which they'll promote music? On Inside Baseball, we share the latest on the many mergers and acquisitions that will dramatically change the entertainment landscape soon. There's the battle royale between CBS and National Amusements. It must have just scuttled the network's merger with Viacom once and for all. Also, Lachlan Murdoch is the official head of New Fox, which they hope will do better than New Coke, which at this point, is it still New Coke since that would be like 30 years old? Anyway, UK regulators, by the way, have no problem with Comcast taking over Sky. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I'm sure with the magic of editing, that's going to sound just great.
I don't know what you're talking about. Everything came out in one take just fine.
Last week, I had to get up at 7 in the morning, which is, I mean, I usually go to bed at about 3 or 4 a.m. So that's really early for me. And I was like, hello, Spoiler, how are you? It was such a bad show for me. This week, you're like, oh, really, it put us together. It's an exciting show we got going. In 5 years or so, we'll probably figure this out. But anyway, we do have Worldwide Box Office, and we've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information, of course, from the trades, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, The New York Times, LA Times. You, our listener, you help us too. Guess what? We've got 25 movies on our chart. And if you grossed just $500,000 anywhere in the world total, you should be on this chart because the number 25 film is Disobedience, and that grossed $498,000 in North America.
Are we going backwards this week?
You know, like I'm just saying, if you know of a movie that grossed at least $500,000 anywhere in the world total, not just one territory, but the whole world combined, it should be on this list. And if it's not, let us know.
That's right. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Facebook, where our link, what is it? Facebook.com/showbizsandbox, or you can follow us on Twitter. I'm getting them mixed up, Michael. I'm really exhausted. You can follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle.
Yeah, just look for the stuff online. So if you grossed $500,000, you got on the charts. If you grossed $6 million, you would be in the top 10 worldwide. But if you wanted to be number one in the world, you had to beat Deadpool 2, which grossed $301 million worldwide. It did very well in North America. It didn't set a record, but it did even better overseas for this R-rated film. $300 million worldwide. The Merc with a Mouth is back.
You know, my kids asked to see this movie, and I went, F no.
Very good. And number two around the world is another comic book movie, Avengers Infinity War, $113 million on the weekend, $1.8 billion worldwide. Where's the other one? We got Black Panther down a little bit. Where is that at? Black Panther, is that still on this charts, isn't it?
Yeah, it has to be, right? I mean, that's
it's
the
at number
point.
18. It grossed under $1 million. It's at $1.3 billion worldwide. That sent me back to the charts to look. I think 16 out of the top 30 highest grossing movies of all time, 16 out of the top 30 worldwide are from Disney.
That's unbelievable, number one. Number two, I was in Target over the weekend, and there was Black Panther already out on DVD and Blu-ray. So, you really can't fault people for not going to see it in the movie theater when they can just go buy it.
They did, but the argument is counter to what you're saying. They went to see the movie in the theater, even though they knew it would probably be in stores, you know, a couple months later.
And you're saying right now, today, 16 of the top 25 are...
16 of the top 30 movies, highest grossing films of all time, came from Disney.
Oh, of all time.
Got the Marvel movies, the Star Wars movies, and the you know, animation film that Disney does so well. That's where you got scattered all throughout the top 30. You got Pirates of the Caribbean, you got, you know. So they are dominating the worldwide box office charts in recent years. And they're going to start doing that on Broadway as well. That made me think, I wonder how many they have. And they've got, I think, four of the top 50 highest, longest running shows in Broadway history are from Disney. Four or five, I should say. So, you know, they're racking that up as well. That takes a longer time for them to move on to the charts, but they are doing it slow but steadily.
Well, in defense of all the other studios out there, when Star Wars was made, the original, the prequels and the original series, they were not Disney properties.
That's right, but they bought Marvel and they bought Star Wars, and I'm sure they wish, oh, if only we'd gotten Harry Potter.
Oh, yes.
The theme park, that was a big miss.
What they'd have to do is they'd have to buy the city of Anaheim just to knock it down and expand Disneyland.
Not that they didn't want Harry Potter. They pushed very aggressively for it, but she just felt it was going to get Disney-fied and American-ified, and that's why she sort of shied away from Spielberg and from Disney. So it ended up being a smart move long-term for J.K. Rowling. Anyway, back to the charts. At number three around the world is How Long Will I Love You? It's a romantic drama from China. It grossed $36 million on its opening weekend. The director is Liu Sun. And it's about a woman in 2018 and a guy in 1999 who wake up in the same bed and find out they can time travel using their bedroom door. Of course. This director's first film, by the way, was about two girls sharing an apartment that was called Lips and Soul. So this one is about two people sharing a bed. I guess the next one, I don't know, they could be sharing a pillow. I don't know how much closer it could get. And I'm not quite sure why she's in 2018 and he's in 1999 rather than 1998. That would just seem to make more sense to me. But a strong, strong opening weekend for this romantic drama. And number four is A Quiet Place. Boy, is this movie racking it up. It's made $175 million in North America. That's amazing for that film. And I always thought it would do better overseas, but it's made so much in North America, it may not catch up. But I think it's going to pass it, but not by as big a margin as I thought. But this horror flick has made $120 million overseas. This weekend it made $22 million, and it's just about to pass the $300 million mark worldwide. That's a lot of numbers, but basically A Quiet Place still racking up a lot of money. It made more than its budget this weekend alone, and it's about to hit $300 million worldwide. And number five is a little counter-programming for the people who weren't going to go see Deadpool. It's Book Club, the movie that all your moms went to see this weekend. $12,500,000 on its opening weekend. Here's what I found interesting. Just like Deadpool and every other movie in North America these days, Book Club opened up on a Thursday, right? Movies don't open up on Friday anymore. They open up Thursday night. We know that's true, correct?
Correct, and they should, they've actually begun to say the four-day weekend total.
Exactly, and they shouldn't be comparing four-day to three-day or adding in the Thursday to Friday. But here's what I found interesting. When I checked out the times on Thursday, usually opening on Thursday means like 7 p.m., 8 p.m.
Now they do matinees.
Well, I have not seen that in New York City at all. Deadpool, the first screening was 7, but Book Club started at 5 p.m., because I thought they said, yeah, you know, the older people who want to see Book Club, they don't want to wait till 7 o'clock.
Oh, that's true. They don't.
They want to get home. They're ready. You know, 5 o'clock, they're ready to see their movie. that's a late start for them. So I'll have to keep an eye. So you're saying like noon on Thursday?
What time? I don't know. Maybe it was 5. I don't know. But I know that they're doing earlier shows for movies like that. And this movie starred Diane Keaton, and you're going to have to help fill this
Mary
in.
Mary Steenburgen.
Anybody else? It's like four.
Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda and?
And Lily Tomlin? Was Lily Tomlin?
No, wait. Could it be Lily Tomlin? I want to say it was...
Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Candice Bergen, Mary Steenburgen. Not to mention Craig T. Nelson, Don Johnson, and Andy Garcia. But basically, the four women in charge were Keaton, Fonda, Bergen, and Steenburgen. And I know one woman who went to see it, and she said, I want to see what they look like. All she wanted to do is go and look at the work they've had done. That's not a joke. That's exactly what she said. All right. Well, at number six, we'll have to keep an eye on how much earlier they keep creeping down on Thursdays. When you've got a big movie like Deadpool, why wait till the evening? You got people ready to go see it at 2 p.m. What are you waiting for? But, you know, that idea of Thursday night is clearly being chipped away at. At number six is Life of the Party. That's the Melissa McCarthy movie. Another $9 million on the weekend, $36 million and counting.
Wait, Life of the Party is a Melissa McCarthy movie? I thought Going Back to School or, you know.
Yes, that's Melissa McCarthy. She's the Life of the Party on college campus. I Feel Pretty is the Amy Schumer movie. Life of the Party is the Melissa McCarthy flick.
I'm getting them all mixed up.
Well, that's because you've been in Cannes watching Art.
Oh, okay.
Not Art is overboard, but it is a hit. $8 million on the weekend. That's at $60 million and counting for the remake of the Goldie Hawn, Kurt Russell. Not classic. Let's not call it a classic. Let's just call it a film. Gabrielle Union has a hit on her hands. Breaking In, another $6 million on the weekend. $30 million and counting. Will Arnett does not have a hit on his hand with Show Dogs, the comedy that's sort of a Turner and Hooch style comedy where he's a cop paired with a dog. $6 million on its opening weekend. I'm sure he's glad Arrested Development is back on action. At number 10 is Dwayne Johnson's Rampage. That passed the $400 million mark. Peter Rabbit is at $335 million. Looking down for some news, we've got Burning, the Cannes film. Very well respected, well reviewed, though some people like Sperling thought it was a bit long. $2.3 million. I assume that South Korean drama has opened up in France.
I want to say it's opened up in South Korea, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That would make sense, that as soon as it premiered in South Korea, it opened in South Korea.
As soon as it premiered in Cannes, it opened in South Korea.
What did I say?
Cannes. You said soon it premiered in South Korea.
Yes.
Well, the other Cannes film, as everybody knows, the Oscar Farhadi film, that's been out for a little while. That is at $4.3 million and counting. I believe that's in France, actually, isn't it?
Or Spain.
Yeah, yes, there's no boy, you know, it's so hard. It would be great when we get these charts. I would love to know two things about movies opening up worldwide. One, I'd like to know how many territories they've opened up in. You know, like if you had a pie chart of the world and your movie has, even if it's playing in one territory like China, if it's already played in every other territory, I want that pie chart to be filled in. If it's only playing in one territory and hasn't opened up anywhere else yet, then only 1% of the chart should be filled in. So you could look at it right away and know, okay, this is just starting to open up, or it's in half the world, or it's in most of the world, or it's all done, and this is the end of the run. You know, that would be a great thing to keep track of, because it's hard. Sometimes movies open 6 months later in this territory or that territory, and you're not sure how much is left.
How about this? I will give you this. Burning, okay, opened on May 17th in South Korea. On 701 screens, it admitted 328,739 people, or at least that's how many tickets it sold, and it earned $2.7 million.
2.7. So ComScore had 2.3, but they've got probably updated figures, I imagine, is what we're looking at. So that's great to hear. So they did a little bit better. That would not move that up to number 13. I Feel Pretty, the Amy Schumer film, would still beat it out, but it's on the chart, so good for them. That's the box office around the world. But in North America, two documentaries are in the top 16. It just so happens for some reason that when we copy over some of the charts that we use, I think we use Box Office Mojo. You'll find them in our show notes.
And ComScore, but yes.
And ComScore. But when we're looking at North America, we look at Box Office Mojo. And for some bizarre reason, we don't pull the top 15 movies. We pull the top 16 movies. And it just so happens that number 16 is a documentary. Which is
Pope Francis, A Man of his word.
That's right. The Pope Francis documentary. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, is in the top 10 for another week. That scored $1.2 million this weekend. It expanded its screens and almost doubled them to about 400. It's grossed $3.8 million total. Scoring $1 million total for a documentary is actually quite good, depending on what you paid for it. But, you know, a documentary grossing $1 million is impressive. This one has done it a couple weeks in a row. It's about to pass $4 million and it's still in the top 10. So really good news for that. And it's fun to see documentaries in the mix in North America.
I noticed that we didn't have a whole lot of films from China on the list this week. Although I would imagine that Deadpool 2, I wonder what opened in China, actually.
Avengers has been there, and that's tearing it up. That's been okay. A huge movie. It's sucking up all the oxygen. That's doing very well. And of course, number three was a very big opener in China, $36 million for How Long Will I Love You. So that's the third biggest hit in the world right now.
That's right.
Yeah, so, you know, between Avengers and How Long Will I Love You, you know, that's a very good showing. But one thing that's neat about China, in North America, we got some documentaries, but China, according to a report from Reuters, according to a report from the Hollywood Reporter, they're looking at how diverse the movies are that are coming to China. They're getting big hits from India, Thailand, Korea, Spain, and of course, North America. You know, these films play in the U.S., but they rarely break into the top 10. Some films from India do, but China really makes a lot of these movies hits, and that's pretty darn impressive. And they're arguing that China is the most diverse film-going audience in the world, that market will make hits out of more films from more territories than any other country.
Now, if you could only get the money out.
We're right, but that's a very positive, strong thing that's happening in China, and we'd love to see that more and more in the U.S. It's exciting when we see a film from India open in the top 10, and we've seen it a few times. It's great when we see a documentary playing in the top 10. It's great when a movie like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Life is Beautiful makes big noise on the charts, but it's rare and rarer for a foreign language film to do that in North America. So full credit to China for them doing that. You know, it's great to see.
Yeah, and you know, I've been waiting for all these stories to crop up, and frankly, you know, over at Celluloid Junkie, we should have probably covered this, but here are some stories about the fact that, you know, there's this whole trade war being bantied about between the U.S. and China, and I thought somehow Hollywood movies would get caught in the middle here, and we thought, well, maybe because China needs to screen movies and they built all these movie theaters that, you know, maybe they'll just kind of skirt by and kind of not bother with Hollywood movies, but it turns out Reuters is saying, no, they're getting sucked into this war.
That's right. There's a big trade war going on. They're having a back and forth. Hollywood is in negotiations and they have lots of different things they're pushing for. And it seemed like they were making progress and being held separately away from all the, you know, soybeans and whatever else you're going to fight about between U.S. and China. But no, they have been dragooned into this. However, others say that the deal is mostly worked out. But the film industry in China has been moved under a government switch that we covered to the propaganda arm. Those are the people overseeing the film industry. And there's no new head of that division yet. So there's nobody really to sign off. So that's part of the problem of what's going on there. So we'll have to see what happens. They're hoping to avoid getting caught up in the whole back and forth, the tit for tat. But one thing that we noticed was that the quota seemed to have fallen by the wayside. And then we understood, no, not quite. Movies are still getting into China, but they're not avoiding the quota so much as being flat fee pickups, meaning a distributor in China will say, okay, we'll buy your movie and take on all the risk. That's what I understood was happening. So once the quota was fulfilled, if they wanted to bring in a film from a country that whose quota was done, they would just have to buy the film outright and take all the risk on themselves. Well, now I get a new insight. It turns out maybe those flat fee pickups aren't flat fees. In fact, they include bonuses when the films hit certain levels. So it's more of a workaround on the quotas than a gamble for either side. So they're avoiding the quota, but by winking and nodding, saying, okay, we'll just pick up your movie with a flat fee. But you know what? If you gross $10 million, you get this money. If you get $50 million, you get this amount of money. So it works out to be sort of, you know, everybody's sharing the risk and the rewards, just like always. So that quota system really is porous now. It is falling by the wayside. Unless this trade war makes them re-put that wall up, it looks like Hollywood and other film industries around the world are getting around that quota system.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no clear evidence that, you know, the Chinese, as certain governments are claiming, are quote-unquote walking away with the intellectual property that belongs to others, whether it's the U.S. or others. Because if you want to distribute a movie in China, you have to go through their distributors. Their distributors get to pick up the movie, and China Film Group is probably the largest of them. So imagine if you could just be a distributor and in your country distribute all of the movies. Want to distribute Avengers 2? You don't have to make it, but you get to distribute it. You want to distribute, the Avengers again, or Star Wars, or Solo, or any, you know what? You just go through China Film Group. They get to distribute all the movies. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, you don't have to be good at your job, do you?
No, you just get to pick up all the movies that are made for Hollywood and elsewhere and distribute them. So if they're successful, great. If they're not, hey, you didn't have much in it anyway.
Well, that's what happens if you're in China. And the same thing happens in Cannes. You sit there and you just let the movies wash all over you, don't you, Sperling? You just got back from the festival and I have one question for you.
What's
that? Are you glad you went?
I'm always glad to have been at the Cannes Film Festival.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of talk this year, more so, I think, than a long time, but what's going on with the festival? But, you know, when all is said and done, even though the films in competition were not exciting, you had to go farther and farther afield to find good movies. It still sounds like people walked away having seen maybe 3 or 4 or 5 movies that will be on their best of the year list. And to me, that's a good con. But we do have a lot of awards winners. And just to give you a quick impression, the big winner was the Palme d'Or for Shoplifter, the Japanese film. Were you happy with that pick?
Well, it's Shoplifters, and Koreeda is the director, and it's Hirokazu Koreeda. Stumbling over his name. I liked Koreeda's film like Father Like Son, which is supposedly being remade by Steven Spielberg at some point.
That's way back on the back burner, isn't it?
Yeah, and certainly Shoplifters is another fine film from Koreeda. He tells these stories that are very slow burns, and they build up very slowly, and at the end, they totally pay off, and you're like, oh my God, that was fantastic! And this is another one of those.
Yeah, it's not Pulp Fiction.
No, it's a film about a family in Japan. They're kind of a poor family. The father is teaching the kids how to shoplift. The question then becomes, what defines a family?
They adopt a street urchin, right?
Yeah, and correct. And that's what I mean by what defines a family. They kind of run across this, 5-year-old girl, and rather than return her to her parents who seem to be abusive, they keep her. And then what is discovered throughout the rest of the film with all the characters in the family is what the film is about.
So do you think this film will be on your best of the year list, or was it more a career award, which happens with the Oscars and happens with the Cannes as well?
No, I think this is definitely one of those movies that will stick with me.
Oh, great. The second prize went to Spike Lee for Black Klansman, which certainly got a lot of good press. People said it was one of his best movies in years, even if they still thought there were some flaws or some sprawling nature to it. But still, great reviews for him. Good buzz. I'm looking forward to seeing it. And, he's been bitter ever since his film Do the Right Thing lost out to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, though I would argue those are two really great films. So, it's not exactly like Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a bad movie. So I wouldn't be that bitter. I'd be bitter if it was a horrible movie you lost to, but not Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Nonetheless, he felt like he was shafted, and now here he is back again. At least they have given him the grand prize, the runner-up.
Yeah, and certainly, look, everything you said about the film is correct. It's like 3/4 of a great film. It kind of falls apart and becomes a little rambling toward the end, like many Cannes films, not just Spike Lee's. Certainly it kind of switches to modern day. I'm not giving anything away. It switches to kind of a preachy modern day. There are, Charlottesville clips at the end. This is all talked about in every review, so I'm not giving anything away.
You are if you haven't read the reviews like me.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, but okay. they're not plot, there's no plot point to it. It's just thrown in.
It's his most commercial movie in a while?
Yeah, probably since 25th Hour and Inside Man.
Yeah, and
it's Inside Man, yeah.
Yeah, other people say it's his best film since When the Levee Breaks, which is certainly his last great movie.
I have not seen When the Levee Breaks, but I'll have to agree.
Terrific. Terrific documentary. Terrific. Okay. Then the third place runner-up is Capernaum. which is a Lebanese film. Again, very well-respected movie at Cannes. Like every art film, some people felt it was too long, but a popular pick that had a really strong, I think, audience reaction when it debuted.
Yeah, now this was a film that, even before the festival started, was pegged as a potential Palme d'Or winner, and that is because it was by Nadine Labaki. She is a female Lebanese filmmaker, so everybody thought, okay, Cate Blanchett being the president of the jury, the year of the woman, everybody thought this, you know, there's only three films directed by women, and here it would be an Arab woman winning the Palme d'Or, and it was picked up by Sony Classics before the festival began. And in France, it was picked up by I think Pathé or Gaumont. I think it was Pathé for over $1.5 million, which for a foreign film in France, that is a lot of money. It was kind of a record. And so people thought this film has got to be great the way it's coming to the film, Cannes Film Festival. It was given a 7 p.m. time slot for a movie with no stars whatsoever. In fact, this is a movie about a Lebanese family and focuses on a possibly 12-year-old boy. We're not sure how old he is. He's not sure how old he is because the family never registered any of the births, because in Lebanon it costs money to register your children and they didn't have the money. The 12-year-old boy runs away, winds up with a migrant worker who has a child, a two-year-old, basically a one-and-a-half-year-old, and then she gets picked up, and he winds up taking care of this one-and-a-half-year-old boy through the streets of Lebanon.
But did you like the film?
I did. It's a very good movie.
A lot of people liked it a lot. So, you know, Shoplifters, Black Klansman, Capernaum, and then we have the Camera Door winner, Girl, directed by Lucas Daunt. I hope I'm saying that properly. It's from the Netherlands. A cisgender boy is playing a girl or transgender, or I forget who he's playing in this.
I was told basically they could not fall behind on their shooting schedule. Let's put it that way.
Because he's growing up.
And transitioning. So.
Wow. So this film got terrific reviews. It's about a person who identifies as a girl who wants to be a ballet dancer. And people just raved about the performance by the kid in this lead role. It won the Best First Film Award. This is certainly a film that's going to be on a lot of critics' lists come the end of the year. It ticks a lot of boxes. It's a very interesting film. Well done. Promising new talent. Terrific performance. And, you know, hot button issue. So, again, when people go to Cannes and they see a lot of films, they're not that good. You know, when you step back and you've got four or five movies that sound really interesting, it sounds like it's going to be a really good Cannes again. That's certainly the case for Paweł Pawlikowski, the Polish director whose movie Cold War won Best Director. And our friend Stephen Garrett, who you went to Cannes with, he said it was his favorite film of the festival.
It is definitely one of my favorite films of the festival, without a doubt. It's a black and white shot in, you know, Academy Ratio 1:3:3. And it's about a love story over the ages of, you know, a singer dancer and a musical director, starting at the end of the World War II. And, you know, they try to, escape, the Iron Curtain. He makes it, she doesn't. And you know, then throughout the decades, they're trying to get back together and it just never works out for them.
Well, thank you for telling the ending of the film.
No, I didn't tell you the ending of the film, did I?
You said it doesn't work out for them.
Not during the... it's an unrequited love story, so you tell me whether. I mean, come on.
Okay. So, yes, another, you know, his film Ida won the Best Foreign Film Oscar. Last Resort was a film of his that I absolutely loved. So he's a real talent. I'm very excited to see that film. Happy as Lazaro, I should say, shared the Best Screenplay Award. You and Stephen liked that, he said. Gaspar Noé's Climax was, of course, a cause célèbre. There's Uncertain Regards winner, Borders, which is sort of a Swedish horror film that a lot of people liked.
It's Border. It was picked up by Neon, which is the distribution arm of Alamo Drafthouse. I talked to Tim League about this, who runs both Neon and Alamo Drafthouse, and he said, you know, he was kind of wondering how they were going to release it. Certainly, they're going to distribute it. It's definitely worth seeing. It is a movie that long past the Cannes Film Festival will stick with me. Definitely worth seeing. There is going to be an issue about how to rate this movie. Not because there's anything, you know, all that, you know, gruesome about it or all that sexual about it. But at the end of the day, we all know that the MPAA has certain rules where if anything is, you know, shown, or if there's a foul language beyond a certain point, it just automatically gets a certain rating. But it's...
Are you talking R versus NC-17?
Correct. Okay. And what I would say is it should be an R. And it is a film definitely worth seeing. I'm not going to give anything else away. I'm really disappointed that Variety did.
Okay. Well, we've got a clutch of movies here that look really interesting. But most of the talk at the festival was not about the films, but about the validity of Cannes and the women's movement. We talked last week about some of the great stuff that happened at Cannes that was interesting. At this time, the noise was from the awards ceremony where Asia Argento called out more people. She said, "Hey, I was raped by Harvey Weinstein."
Yes.
And this was his hunting ground. And she says, "There are more of you here who are complicit." And she said, quote, "You know who you are, but most importantly, we know who you are, and we will not allow you to get away with it any longer." So that was a memorable, stunning moment, followed almost immediately by the fact that an actress filed a complaint with the police saying director Luc Besson drugged and raped her on May 10th. In Paris, after meeting him at a hotel about a film project. She'd done two films with him already. Not only did he say he didn't do it, his spokesperson said, quote, "Mr. Besson fell from his chair when he learned of these accusations," which he flatly denies. And so that's a new level of denial. He fell out of his chair. That's how shocked he was by this complaint filed with the police. But Me Too continues.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, is this a good time to get into that? Do we want to talk about our sexual harassment section now?
Or? Yeah, let's jump ahead to that. So, we've got a couple news with NCIS. That's a huge franchise, one of the most watched TV franchises in the world. The series has been going on and on. The first one stars Mark Harmon. You've also got NCIS New Orleans, NCIS Miami, I think.
NCIS Los Angeles, isn't there, like with...
LA with a,
LL Cool J, I think, isn't that?
Our friend, exactly. And it made news for not great reasons. Pauly Perrette has been a big part of the show. She's a cool, quirky character. She finally left the show at the end of this season. Her exit brought a big spike to the ratings. People were sorry to see her go, but she's been in there since the start. And people were wondering why she left after all. It's been like over a decade. Nonetheless, there were rumors and reasons. Why did she leave? And she finally tweeted out about it and said she faced multiple physical assaults from somebody on the show. But she also says the network and the show owners were responsive and good. She felt like she kept it quiet to protect the show and the other people who had jobs. And now she wonders if that was the right choice. This, of course, leads you to wonder, well, who the hell is she talking about? Which leads, who could be that important that if she talked about it, it would bring the show down? That leaves you with like the creator or Mark Harmon, which isn't really fair to them. And I say to her, don't keep it quiet. If you got to complain about someone, just tell it, face the piper, tell the music. But anyway, that she wanted to spell out why she left that show. And at the same time, the people behind NCIS removed Brad Kern, the showrunner of NCIS New Orleans. They'd had multiple workplace complaints about him, not about sexual misconduct as such, but about just abusive behavior and not treating fellow workers right. He got sensitivity training for 6 months. He's been investigated twice in the past. Then he had further misconduct allegations, and now he's finally been removed from the show. So... these are big, valuable franchises, and more we're seeing that not just waiting for like sexual misconduct or police reports to be filed, but they're actually taking some steps, forcing people to take sensitivity training, putting them on notice, and then removing them from a show. And these are very popular, profitable shows. So, she felt like she had to leave the show, but she speaks well about the network and the show owners. This show, they've removed the guy in charge. People perhaps are paying a price. Perhaps they're willing to say, if you're abusive to your coworkers, we need to do something about it. We can't just look the other way.
And in fact, what we need to do is not promote your music on Spotify.
That's right. So Spotify said last week, hey, we've got these new rules. You can be on Spotify, but we're not going to promote you and we're not going to put you in our algorithms to automatically say, oh, you like this song, maybe you like that song. We're not going to do that if we decide you fall out of bounds of our conduct and we feel like you're not an artist we want to associate ourselves with. We're not going to blacklist you from the service. We're just not going to promote you. And the first person they did that with was R. Kelly and two other artists, all three of whom happen to be people of color. And record labels and other people said, well, wait a second. Like, none of these people have been charged with anything. And why are they all black? You know, what about Eminem, said an activist group. What about the guy who drums on Layla, who's serving time for murdering his mother? How come you're promoting Layla on Spotify? You know.
Wait, you mean the Eric Clapton song, Layla?
Yeah, yeah. The drummer on that song is in jail for killing his mother. And they say, well, why are you promoting that song?
Well, because maybe it's not considered, it's considered an Eric Clapton song. We don't even know the name of the drummer. Okay. So that maybe
well,
that's
they're just
why.
Saying, they're just saying, well, why are you promoting music that is going to profit murderers? You know, they're just saying when you open up a can of worms and you're saying these people haven't been convicted of anything, but you're promoting another song that features musicians who are in jail for murder or rape or other crimes, you know, where's your decision-making process? And why was it only three people of color? What about all these white people who have got questionable things going about them? And you know what? I think they did make a poor mistake in sort of the first three people, the way it looks and how they did it. You know, when you're going to just randomly choose people, you open up a big can of worms. Spotify says, hey, we work with the Southern Poverty Law Center. We work with the ADL and GLAAD and Color of Change. We didn't do this on our own and we didn't do it willy-nilly. Maybe the optics don't look good for the first three people we chose, but we're not trying to say that everybody on our service is perfect or the people that we promote are all lovable, but we're just saying we decided to make this first step with R. Kelly and some other artists because of what we've been told about them. But it does open a big, ugly, messy can of worms, doesn't it?
It most certainly does.
Yeah, and so does MoviePass. They keep making news. You were in Cannes, but by God, that didn't stop MoviePass from, you know, making news.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say, it made so much news. I didn't know whether I was reading old news, new news, whether this news was already known about...
Well, tell us about the financial report. I like this.
Well, you're going to have to tell me about the financial report because, you know, I haven't read it yet, but apparently they're actually making money. Somewhat.
No, that's not what
sort of.
That's not what they...
Maybe
they're
a little.
Yeah, the reporting where their income came from. The vast majority of it came from subscriptions, meaning, you know, I pay my $10 a month and that's most of their income. But of course, what they keep saying is what we're really going to make money is with, you know, advertising and all these other areas we're going to generate income. Well, we finally got some hard figures. They grossed $1 million in revenue from everything else.
Okay.
You got subscriptions, and then everything else was $1 million. In other words, they ain't making diddly squat from anything else yet. So that's the first, you know, solid numbers we have. That's about 50 cents per subscriber, very roughly. That's for an entire quarter. They made $1 million in the first quarter of 2018. That's $330,000 a month from everything other than subscriptions, meaning they ain't making anything. 16 cents a month a subscriber. That's what they're making on ads and everything else. So all their money is coming from subscription. Their plans to make money in other areas have not borne fruit yet. And so they keep changing the rules, right? They've got some new rules now. They're beta testing a new requirement for MoviePass. Did you get this?
I am so far behind in my emails that maybe I didn't.
As you know, certain members must photograph their ticket stub and send it to MoviePass as proof they attended, even though I'm sending pictures before it gets torn. I don't know if that's right or not, but they haven't said anything. I'm like, what's the point of this? If you're going to sell it, you could take a picture and then sell it. But now they've got a new rule. It's a requirement for some members that you have to write and text them a limerick that incorporates the title of the movie that they're going to see. I think that's just crazy.
Well, I think it's crazy because half the people that you're asking to do that won't actually know what a limerick is.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a bridge too far. That's what I think. But we also had a bridge too far on television.
We must say for those people who don't understand, that was a joke.
No, that's not a joke. It's really happening. In TV, the upfronts are over. That's where the major networks roll out all their new fall programming and advertisers line up to hand them piles of cash. It gets a lot of news. A lot of money is changing hands. Despite the 5,000 channel universe and all these streaming services, the big five, six major networks still make a lot of money, don't they?
They do. I know that the thing that I noticed coming out of the upfronts was that Brooklyn Nine-Nine was canceled. I don't know if you heard about that, Michael, but it was all over social media. It was all over the news. That's all I could read about. And then it was canceled by Fox, and then it was picked up by NBC. And, you know, that's pretty much what I learned out of the upfronts this year.
Well, what you were learning there was that ownership is everything. Pretty much everyone either owns or co-owns every show on their network. There's a few examples counter to that, but that is just, it's been the story for years. It's gotten stronger and stronger. And now when a show is canceled, the people who own it say, oh, wait a second, we want a few more episodes because Brooklyn Nine-Nine is just getting close to syndication. We're going to pick that sucker up. NBC always felt like they should not have let that show get away. They felt like it was a better fit for them than Fox. And they made good on their promise. So they know the syndication line of 100 episodes is just in view. They think the show works on their network. It works for their brand. And they want to be in the Andy Samberg business. And so they picked it up.
And I have to say that I have been told by numerous people that I should be watching this show.
It's a good ensemble. It's an amusing little show. It's not one that I watch every week, but I enjoy it when I see it. Okay. And certainly it's not Arrested Development. And we have a follow-up story for that. We were talking last week about how they were kind of annoyed because they had a 17-episode season. And then for syndication purposes, those 17 episodes were re-edited into 22 episodes. And they said, excuse me, I get paid per episode. So if you're going to turn my work into 22 episodes, I'd like more money. And it turned out that's exactly what they did.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. Good on Netflix for... doing
well,
that.
I wouldn't say good. They had to be pressured and forced and threatened with, you know, an uprising from their creative talent. And they said, no, you need to pay us more. And they said, all right,
fine.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think it's not a big deal because, you know, they're making a lot of money anyway. Netflix is like, well, come on, we're keeping your show alive. But no. You make more episodes out of it, you got to pay more money.
Well, speaking of big deals, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, advertisers love NBC's plan to get rid of a lot of ads in prime time. Who wants to fight for attention among a glut of commercials? Well, no one. They like the plan, they just don't want to pay for it. NBC is making its pitch at upfronts. What we were just talking about. They'll cut national TV ads in prime time by 20%. They'll feature ads in new pods with far fewer ads, so consumers will be less likely to skip over the spots and more likely to remember them. And they want double the ad rate from last season. So
double?
Yes. That's where you lost every advertiser. They went, yes. No. So a $700,000 ad on Sunday Night Football, guess what? That'll cost $1.4 million. Is this step one in negotiations or the new normal? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop in terms of how much they're trying to ask for. I think it's just the first step in negotiations. You're like, okay, you're cutting ads by 20% and doubling the price. Why aren't you cutting the cost by 20%? You know, it just doesn't really make any sense. But, you know, they had success on a less dramatic level doing the same thing with Saturday Night Live. They cut down on the ads and they increased the cost of those ads, and it helped. However, that Saturday Night Live was airing live across the country and getting more attention that it had enjoyed probably in decades. And it was becoming, you know, really must-see television for a lot of people. So that, you know, that show was on fire, whereas primetime in general is not on fire for the networks. It's a case of like, we're reaching fewer people, but we're still reaching more than cable.
Did you see the opening monologue, Tina Fey doing the opening monologue this week?
I do not watch Saturday Night Live.
Okay, well, it's kind of funny because it's so watched now that between Robert De Niro and Fred Armistead, I mean, there were like five or six, Jerry Seinfeld, the five or six celebrities in this one.
Jerry Seinfeld was on it? I know exactly. Ben Stiller was on. What did Jerry Seinfeld play?
He wanted to know why they weren't asking him to do, you know, celebrity cameos.
He
was like, you know, questions from the audience and you, sir. He's like, hi, I'm wondering, how come you don't have me doing, I hear I look like Steve Mnuchin. I could do that.
Oh, I was thinking, you know, Jared Kushner, but of course he's 20, 30 years too old.
Right, exactly. Now, the book industry has some okay news to start off 2018, according to Publishers Weekly. After the first quarter, the big four publishers all had a decent story to tell about sales. HarperCollins is up 6% year-to-year for the January through March period. Profits are up 16%, which leads us to where the good news is coming from. Digital, audio, and backlist titles, both of which have higher margins. Hachette saw a 5% gain in sales. Houghton Mifflin had a small sales increase, while Simon & Schuster had a fall in sales, but a rise in profits of just $1 million. Another indication of better margins, by the way. The biggest U.S. publisher, Penguin, Random House, guess where they are? There are no actual figures, so we have no idea. Big deal or big whoop.
I'm going to say a big whoop because the story promised, hey, good news. And most of it was modest to no news because they didn't even want to tell us. So yeah, they're getting better margins because audiobooks are still on fire. That's great. Ebooks are continuing to flatline. I'm getting concerned. And they're still, I believe, the most popular format for new releases, like a new John Grisham book, a new Stephen King, a new best-selling nonfiction book. Most people are going to buy it in ebook. That's great. But e-readers are dying on the vine. There are no new e-readers. The loss of the Nook is really going to have a big impact. The Kindle is sort of, you know, mellow in sales. So I think the fact that people are switching to phones and all this sort of stuff, digital audio is exploding, but ebooks should keep growing, but it's not because people are not sort of keeping that format front and center. So the news overall is not great. It's at least it's not a disaster.
And the winner is Warner Brothers. That's the studio that landed rights to turn the Tony-winning musical In the Heights into a movie musical. The project was first at Universal with Kenny Ortega set to direct, but they put it into turnaround. Then it was at the Weinstein Company, but blah, 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 fall from grace, and we all know how that ended. Now Warner Brothers has snapped up the hot property. Expect the Lin-Manuel Miranda hip-hop musical to come out. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Deadline said the deal was a $50 million package, including first dollar gross for the filmmaking team. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's just a movie deal. What I wanted to know was who has the rights to Hamilton, and I couldn't figure it out. Maybe the movie rights haven't been sold yet.
I don't know.
So I think the reason I would think it might be a big deal is not that this isn't a worthy project on its own, but what you really want is Hamilton. And if you do this right, and well, it's a stupid way. You don't make a movie just so you can make another movie. But hey, you want this project and you know, do it right, do it well, make him happy, and you might be first at the table to get Hamilton. So, you know, you want to make money with this. It's a great project. You want it to happen. But dear God, you really want Hamilton.
Well, what I can't wait for is going to Broadway to see the revision of In the Heights, the new musical In the Heights, which will be based on the movie, which will be based on the musical.
Oh, okay.
In the last year at the upfronts, Hulu said, why all this emphasis on paid subscribers? When everyone else said, well, that's our best and easiest measurement of success. Well, Hulu caved. Or maybe they just had a good story to tell. In January, Hulu claimed 17 million subscribers. Now, just 4 months later, they've hit 20 million, just as season two of Emmy winner The Handmaid's Tale starts streaming. The company's upcoming lineup includes George Clooney's Catch-22 miniseries, a Mindy Kaling spin on Four Weddings and a Funeral, a new spin on the kids' cartoon series Animaniacs, and
we're Animaniacs.
Yeah, God, that's talk about a memory. And there's a new deal to be the home for films by DreamWorks Animation. Hulu says their audience averages 31 years old, and the live TV and their skinny bundle have supercharged the service. Hulu viewers watched some 3 billion hours of content in 2017. No wonder productivity in the U.S. is down. Big deal or big whoop?
Productivity is up. That ain't the problem. Wages are down. Wages are down.
Okay.
It's a big deal. You know, they're growing the service. They got a signature show. The mix of stuff is working. So they're doing great. And Animaniacs Live is here in New York at the Joe's Pub. The creator and the guys who did the voices are together at Joe's Pub doing like songs from the show. I couldn't be more excited.
Is Woody Allen still doing his show there every Monday night?
That was not at Joe's Pub. Joe's Pub is an offshoot of the Public. But yeah, Woody still does perform, I believe.
Okay. Ocean Cruises. I'm just going to end that story there. No, just kidding. Ocean Cruises have featured Broadway-style entertainment for generations. But many years ago, it transformed from cheesy reviews to actual Broadway shows and original productions, all of them, by the way, featuring talent that worked in theater on dry land. At the very least, they were reaching the level of touring productions. They got better on every level. The only area that didn't get better, guess what it was? That's right, their paychecks. But for the first time, Actors Equity struck a limited deal with Norwegian Cruise Lines. When a ship was docked in New York City, performances of Jersey Boys and a new revue called Havana were covered by a union contract. Both sides acknowledge this symbolism of the moment and the possibility it will lead to more union shows down the road. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And will they get some of that seasick medicine in as well?
Perhaps. I'm sure medical is included, okay, at least while you're on the ship.
Oh,
I think it's I think it's a big deal. These have been, you know, increasingly professional productions. I've had friends who've worked on cruise ships. They're really good shows. They're good training grounds, like soaps are for actors. You know, the cruise lines can be for, you know, theater gypsies. You're not supposed to say gypsies anymore. I beg your pardon. Can be for theater dancers and performers. So it's a great way to, you know, spread your wings and try stuff out. And guess what? Havana was created by Warren Carlyle. He's the director and choreographer of Broadway shows like Hugh Jackman's On Broadway and After Midnight, which I liked a lot. He did the choreography on Hello Dolly, She Loves Me, and On the 20th Century. He just directed Me and My Girl at the Encores. So they've got big talent working on these shows, and they should be union productions, and I'm glad to see it. And by the way, I did double check. Woody Allen still is at the Cafe Carlyle every Monday night.
It wasn't Cafe Carlyle originally, I'll tell you that.
No, it moved. It moved over, yeah.
Yeah. U.S. copyright is often referred to as the Mickey Mouse Law, because Disney is determined that Uncle Walt's most famous creation never passes into the public domain. Congress has the right to set copyright for a limited time, and when they last extended it in 1998, a legal challenge went all the way to the Supreme Court. The case lost because the justices said surely Congress was done. They shouldn't be doing this anymore. Copyright was being pushed to last a creator's life plus 70 years, and for works created before 1976, it was a straight 95 years, which means Mickey would be safe until, let's see, carry the one. So, oh, whoa, 2023, crimey, that's just 5 years from now. So Congress they've swung into action. The House passed an unrelated bill that included a passage for music work, it included musical works only. Okay, so that's their new bill that would grant those created before 1972 a total of 144 years of copyright protection. Mickey, we're sure, can't be too far behind. The bill has moved to the Senate. Big deal or big whoop?
Okay, to clarify, copyright in general, they've got all these different rules. Music copyright, there's this weird loophole where stuff before 72 falls outside the agreement that Congress made back in the 70s. And so that's created all sorts of issues. And now they've passed this new bill to extend copyright for stuff before 1972 for 144 years. How the hell did they come up with 144 years? And how is that even remotely sane? That is just absurd. But it's moving through the Congress. And if that happens, believe me, Mickey and the rest of it's going to follow suit some way. It's totally ridiculous. It does not benefit the public. It doesn't benefit artistry. It doesn't benefit artists. It's just, you know, a corporate grab. It really should be fought, and hopefully Congress won't pass it, but it's already passed the House, and the Senate will probably perhaps follow suit.
YouTube has a premium music service. I'm just going to end there. No, I'm kidding. Now, of course, they've had this music service before. Now they have it again. You can watch it for free with ads, or you can pay $10 a month to see it ad-free. YouTube launched it in 5 territories, including the U.S., Mexico, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. One of the key spruced-up features? Guess what it is? The service now makes further recommendations that draw on more than artist videos. You also get pointed towards official videos like artist appearances on late-night TV or artist interviews. No bootleg stuff, but it does lead you to the wider, richer library of YouTube, which they see as a key advantage over other services. Big deal or big whoop?
We'll have to see how it plays out. Right now, it's a big whoop. Spotify has 75 million paying customers. Apple has 40 million paying customers. I don't know what YouTube music service has or whether they call it Red or what it's called, but, you know, it's nowhere near that. But I did think that was sort of an interesting spin. You know, if you're on Spotify, you listen to an artist, they say, what about listening to Courtney Barnett's other album? Or if you like Courtney Barnett, maybe you'll like, I don't know, Bob Dylan. But with YouTube saying, hey, you like Courtney Barnett? Here's her interview on Charlie Rose, or, you know, here's her performance on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. I'm making all that stuff up, but that is interesting to me, you know, that they could pull all these video and stuff to sort of support your interest in an artist in ways that no other service can do. That does make it different. I don't know if it's worth $10 a month, but it's an interesting twist.
Warner Music Group sold off 75% of its stake in Spotify for a total of $400 million. Some $300 million will go to shareholders in the company. The rest will be distributed amongst its labels as per previous agreements. In other words, they'll share if they have to do so, okay?
Meaning they won't.
Right. Direct payment to artists for the hundreds of millions of dollars earned on the music they created? Yeah, that is going to be zero. Warner said this shouldn't be seen as a lack of confidence in Spotify's future. Sony already sold off 17% of its stake, and Universal may do the same. Warner Music Group said that they don't typically hold onto stakes in publicly traded companies, and this was the reason they offloaded most of their stock. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm not sure. I guess it's a big whoop. I mean, their argument is good. They're like, well, we don't have a stock portfolio. You know, we don't keep a mix of stocks on hand. So, you know, if we own a piece of a company and it's related to our business, then we'll do that. But otherwise, why would we? Well, wait a second. Spotify seems awfully related to what you do. So why wouldn't you want a big stake in Spotify? So I'm not sure what to think of all this. What do you think?
I think that whoever cut the deal for Spotify and you know these labels all buying into it did a really big disservice to them by not mandating that they hold on to these shares and sell them off in chunks as opposed to all at once, because you know by having all of these sell-offs you're lowering the stock price, and you know they should have just worked that into their deal. I do think, as we've always said, this was going to happen, that the labels would make a fortune by owning a piece of Spotify and providing content that was created by the musicians, and the musicians would never see a dime. And guess what? That's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not sure what their 52-week high is at, but Spotify's at $150.94 right now.
Oh, so maybe it's not affecting them at all.
But still, you're right that they should have had a clause saying, hey, you can sell off 10% after 1 year and, you know, whatever. Something like that would have made sense. Here's a side note. We were talking about smart speakers and how they're affecting the music industry. And in the UK, they're really doing it because they have a rule about when should they dump analog radio? When should the government stop supporting it? And their decision was, well, we'll stop supporting it when the audience for digital, when the audience listening to digital is over 50%. When most people listen to digital, then we'll get rid of analog. Well, it turns out because of smart speakers, suddenly that's happened a lot sooner than they expected. The audience for digital is now over 50%, and the government's saying, well, hold on a second.
We have a lot of old people.
A lot of people are old. They're in cars. People in cars have not switched to digital, so this would be a little sooner than we want. We're going to rethink this.
We don't know if you saw the wedding, you know, Markle and Harry, and you know, Meghan and Harry over the weekend, but they're still driving around in a coach and a buggy, okay?
So we've got a lot of work to do. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. Smart speakers are really having a ripple effect in what music people are listening to, where they're listening to it, and how they get access to new music.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Mergers, acquisitions.
That's pretty much what we're talking about here. And we talked about, you know, Fox being cut into two. There was the stuff that was going to be sold to Disney, which is 20th Century Fox, and there was going to be this new Fox, which we kind of joked around was going to be like New Coke. I don't think New Coke still exists, by the way. Lachlan Murdoch is now officially the head of New Fox. Is it really being called New Fox? Seriously?
I guess. I'm not sure. It seems like it.
Yeah, his father, Rupert Murdoch, will be the co-chairman. New Fox consists of the Fox News Channel, the Fox TV Network, Fox Business, Fox Sports, and the TV Station Group. Disney, of course, is going to pay that $52 billion for the 20th Century Fox film and TV studio, the FX Cable Channel, National Geographic, the Regional Sports Channels, and Star India. Disney also gets their share of Hulu, which gives Disney 60% of that streaming service. Disney may also get 39% of Sky, unless that's blocked by the EU, because the regular leaders in the EU are, you know, trying to fight that. Disney may also get 39% of Sky, which they actually won't. Wouldn't they? They would get it, right? 39% of Sky, because that's what Fox owns, correct?
That's right. Unless this merger is blocked by EU regulators,
right? And the merger is they want to buy the rest of Sky. Okay, so Fox wants to buy 100% of Sky, and the EU is saying no. And along comes Comcast, and they've made a deal, or they've made an offer. So now what's going on with the whole Comcast-Sky thing? You explain that part of this story.
Well, they're waiting to see if the merger between AT&T and Time Warner goes through. I mean, Comcast is bidding for the stuff that Disney's buying. Comcast also wants a piece of Sky. Comcast is also waiting to see what happens with AT&T and Time Warner. AT&T and Time Warner are waiting to see what happens with Disney and Fox. I mean, and James Murdoch is launching his own company and say, Dad always liked you better. That's what he's saying to Lachlan. It's just there are so many mergers happening. They all are so intertwined that it's really when this all settles down, it's going to be a dramatic change to the entire entertainment landscape. No matter what happens, a lot is going to be different.
Well, and that's, you know, we talked about whether Cannes was still Cannes and all of that. Well, that's kind of what you're seeing, right? I mean, the fact that the film industry landscape is different. Thank you, Netflix. Thank you, Amazon Prime. Thank you, you know, disruptors. And so is television is going to be the same way.
I feel like Netflix is more of a disruptor in TV than film, but maybe I'm being foolish. I feel like that's really more of their world. I know they're moving into film. Netflix is increasing their original films they're making. They're going to be making about 80 new movies this year, though I didn't see what their total budget was for that in particular, what size movies they're making, but and whether that includes pickups. They did pick up a couple films at Cannes. Just for North America and a few other markets, not worldwide. I thought that was interesting.
Well, they picked up Girl, in fact. They picked up.
But not for the world. Not for the world, no, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, because Girl is actually, I think it's an Argentinian film.
Isn't it Netherlands?
I thought, yeah, but I think it was set in Argentina. I don't know. I'd have to double check. Oh, but they bought Happy as Lazaro and Girl.
But not for the world, and I thought they're world players. And in fact, one of the reasons they say they're adding in so many movies is because most of their audience is overseas, it's not in the United States, and their growth is happening overseas.
That is correct.
And their product, the work that they are creating needs to reflect that. That's why we've been covering for several years how they're making a Brazilian TV show and a French TV show and a Japanese TV show. Well, their movies need to reflect that as well. So that's what they're doing. Well, but I still thought it was weird that they weren't picking them up for the world.
Yeah, they may not have been available for the world. That's why.
Picked them up for wherever they were. That right. Makes sense. Other deals are still being, you know, all of these deals are in the air as we wait to see what regulators say, what gets passed in the U.S., what gets passed in the EU. You know, Comcast wants to take over Sky. Of course, Fox wants to do that and then sell it off to Disney. Comcast is making a rival bid. And UK regulators weighed in and said, yeah, we've got no problem with that. That would be fine.
Yeah, that's because they haven't, you know, they don't have to deal with Comcast Internet.
Well, Comcast doesn't, well, yes, but it's also because
that
Comcast
was a joke,
doesn't.
By the way, feel free to laugh.
No, it's not a joke. It's a reasonable comment. That's why Comcast is more of an issue in North America. In the EU, they're concerned about Fox because they have such a big media footprint in the UK. Comcast doesn't have that. So them taking over Sky does not mean one person is dominating the media landscape the way Fox has been. So that's why it's a reasonable comment to make.
Well, you know, they're actually coming after you right now because you're talking about them.
You can hear them. That's right. And the biggest story of all, which is like, holy moly, has to be the blow up of the merger between CBS and Viacom.
Yeah. Now, this was another one that I actually asked people who are employed by CBS. I said, can you explain this to me? And they were all like, nah, no, we can't. They tried and then they were, okay, we actually have no idea what's going on. But basically, CBS and Paramount, Viacom, they're all owned by National Amusements, which are owned by the Redstones, okay? And basically, the Redstones want to remerge CBS with Viacom. And Les Moonves and CBS is saying, hey, you know, we're really, really profitable, and we do a really, really good job, and we don't want to take on this cancer called Paramount and Viacom. So we don't want that, thank you very much, and we're going to sue you to prevent it.
And they did all sorts of boardroom shenanigans on both sides. The courts have put a pause on everything. But right now, it seems like it's such a poisonous atmosphere that the merger probably won't happen. No matter what happens, it's not going to happen. As for why it's not happening, the first argument was, well, we're doing great on our own. Why you're just pushing us back together for other reasons is not a reasonable thing to do. It's not going to be good for shareholders. The other angle was that Les Moonves wanted his second in command to be the heir apparent, whereas Sherry Redstone wanted her favorite to be the heir apparent, and Les Moonves was not willing to stand for that. That was another problem in the negotiations. What the truth is, I don't know. But as far as whether it's good for CBS, the fact is when they split them up, everybody thought this was really going to benefit Viacom. they were going to be the big winners from the split up. It turned out it was CBS. So when we say who's going to benefit or be hurt when we remerge, well, maybe everybody thinks CBS will be hurt, but who knows? You know, they can argue, well, clearly it would be bad for us. Well, guess what? You thought it was going to hurt you last time, and it didn't. It was really good for you. And the funny thing is, if this does not happen, as seems likely, that now it's become so poisonous, it's just not going to happen, because they really wanted Les Moonves to be in charge, and clearly he does not get along with Sherry Redstone. So if this falls apart, that means, great, CBS gets to remain independent. They don't have to merge with a big conglomerate like Viacom. Oh, but wait. If they don't merge with Viacom, now everyone is saying they're clearly going to have to merge with someone else. Does that make any sense?
No, not at all.
That's exactly what the three or four different stories said. Is, well, they're going to be in play, and they're going to need to find another home because
I see what they're saying. They're basically saying that now that that a price has been put on them, somebody's going to come along and try and buy them. So unless they merge with somebody else, somebody will buy them anyway.
Right. So it would be a bad idea to merge with Viacom, but it's a good idea to merge with someone else. You know, it seems crazy. They're like, no, we don't want to merge. But of course, now we will.
Well, for now, it looks like there's a pause on the deal if it's not dead already.
I don't know if the deal is dead yet, but I know that some people have unfortunately died while you were away at Cannes. Always sad news. Margot Kidder was certainly a sad story. She died at 69 years old, had some mental health issues later in her life, but apparently, according to one obituary, she strongly recovered from that and had a good solid last 3 years. So that's nice to hear. Obviously, she'll be remembered forever for her role as Lois Lane in Superman, a great, great film. Still the best superhero film of all time.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's the one that started it all, sort of. Not really, actually. But I was a big fan of Tom Wolfe, actually. The Right Stuff. He was an author. He wrote The Right Stuff. He was also a journalist.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he pioneered new journalism. He was one of the major figures. And quite the dandy, quite the figure, the media figure. I've never really read him. I have not read anything by Tom Wolfe.
Bonfire
I read individual-
of the Vanities.
Yeah, that one I never had any interest in. I will read it at some point someday. But yeah, you know, he's sort of a, you know what? Actually, I read it when it was being serialized in Rolling Stone and I got bored. I just didn't like, you know, I love serialized books. You know, I love Dickens and I was totally into it, but I just did not really enjoy it while I was reading it. And
tongue. Wow.
It happens, but I'm always wanted to read The Right Stuff. I love that film. And he's certainly a major figure in journalism. And certainly Bill Gold is a major figure in movie poster legend, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So Bill Gold is a graphic designer and an illustrator, and he died at the age of 97. He started working with Warner Brothers in the 1940s and worked on a small little film called Casablanca. He was the one that they put the gun in Humphrey Bogart's hand. And if you look at the poster, you can kind of see it's just kind of like thrown in there, right? It doesn't even look right. But, you know, that's what helped that film, you know, make it look more than just a talky love story.
Yeah, who wants romance? Well, he worked at Warner Brothers, and then he worked for a lot of people. He developed a long relationship with Clint Eastwood. And, you know, it's a credit to him that when you think of some movies like A Clockwork Orange or The Exorcist or Woodstock or Goodfellas, you can probably picture the poster that went along with the movie. That's saying something, because you can't do that with most films.
That's true. Of course,
these are famous movies, but they're also famous posters. You know, you can have a great movie with a poster you don't remember. You can have a poor movie with a great poster. Bill Gold was lucky enough to have such a good, long, lengthy career. He did a little bit of both.
Well, speaking of things that are dying, we're kind of dying here on the Vine with our last little bits for this week's show, but we will be back next week. We do thank you for listening to each and every episode we put out. In fact, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us. You can rate and review us. And please do rate and review us. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show. It helps promote us on those platforms. Again, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find us. You can find those links on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information, as well as all links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
NextYearInCon.com.
Oh, I see. It's like the
next year in Jerusalem, next year in Cannes. I'll return to Cannes someday, by God. Even though it was a dead, boring year, there still were like 15 or 20 movies I really wish I could have seen.
And you'll probably see them at the New York Film Festival or Toronto or someplace else.
I hope so.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to, you know, michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I went to the film The Avengers. It has nothing to do with Sue Menger's. I'm not a big fan, but I like Spider-Man, and if they hurt that boy, I'll avenge her.
Oh, that's a limerick, right? Is that the
idea? Yes, yeah. That's my limerick. I had to do my limerick for the movie.
Well, they may as well just kick me out of MoviePass right now. I'll never get that down.